You are Locked On Bulls, your daily podcast on the Chicago Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome to another episode of Locked On Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. Make sure you leave us a five-star review. You can always find us on Stitcher, Audio Boom, TuneIn, Google Play, anywhere that you can find podcasts. Make sure you check out plenty of the other podcasts in the Locked On Podcast Network. Check out Locked On Bears with Arthur Arkush, Locked On NBA, Locked On NFL, Locked On Fantasy Basketball, Locked On Fantasy Football, any of the great individual team podcasts on the network throughout the NBA and the NFL. You can email us with any basketball questions or advertising inquiries at LockedOnBulls@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at LockedOnBulls. Like us on Facebook at LockedOnBulls. I'm Sean Hyken of The Athletic. With me, as always, Cody Westerlund of 670 The Score. And Cody, are you excited for the Doug McDermott homecoming game tomorrow?
The reunion in Omaha. Bulls finish off the preseason against the Atlanta Hawks. And Doug gets to face Kyle Korver on the other side. Two Creighton products. Bulls' last chance to get a glimpse of what they have before entering the 82-game slate of the regular season. And Doug might get to wow the crowd by starting, Sean.
That's right. Fred Hoiberg said today at practice that as of right now, they're going to start their usual starters with Taj Gibson starting at the four. And then he said he's thinking about starting Doug just because of where the game is. He didn't say whether he would be at the three or at the four. I would assume it would be at the four because he's not going to not start Rondo, Wade, or Butler.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I mean, Doug is also, I mean, primed to play backcourt all year. Like, the Bulls talked about playing him at the four a little bit, but they have so many big men in the mix down low that if they start him at the four, it's because they want to see in the backcourt how those three can work together more than wanting to see what Doug can do at the four, I think, if any of that makes sense.
Right, but the decision to start Doug is not because they want to see what Doug can do. The decision to start Doug is because he's playing in front of fans that know him from his college years. I don't think if Fred decides to start Doug, then at that point it's not because of, you know, regular season implications.
They need to fly one of those airplanes over with like a message attached on the back, you know, as soon as they get to Omaha, like start Doug, and just have a bunch of signage and billboards up to push Fred toward that. But
last year at the Nebraska game, again, I believe it was against the Mavericks, he hit the game winning shot.
He did. It was like a little fadeaway, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think that one was in Lincoln or something.
Yeah, it was in Lincoln.
And that was kind of the start of a breakout second season for Doug after what was a disappointing rookie season because he didn't get a lot of playing time and had a knee injury that needed some minor surgery. No surgery's minor, I should say, but all things considered, it was a routine procedure, but he just didn't get an opportunity under Tom Thibodeau there in Tibbs last year in Chicago. Much better under Fred Hoiberg in year two. 42.5%, I think, on three-pointers or so, like the sixth best mark in the NBA. And look, the Bulls are counting on Doug McDermott, and we were talking about this off-air the other day. We're kind of both buying in to Doug to take a leap. Not to be an all-star, not to wow people from coast to coast every night on NBA highlights, but to take that next step for the Bulls.
I agree. I think he's going to have a pretty good year in the sense that, I mean, we know that he has one absolutely elite world-class skill, which is three-point shooting. But last year, he was so bad at every single other aspect of playing basketball that even with how good of a three-point shooter he wasn't really able to stay on the floor consistently. This year, I mean, at least in preseason so far, he's looked a lot more comfortable scoring in other ways besides just hitting threes. He's been rebounding the ball better. He's still not a good defender, but he's still trying on that end. I mean, he's young enough. I think there's hope that he'll get better. But I think you and I are both optimistic for what Doug is going to do this year.
Yeah, you brought up the one elite skill, and I mean, that's kind of an age-old, time-tested truism in the NBA. If you have one elite skill at something, there will be a place for you in the league. If you can bring more to the court or just be average, capable, dependable in the other aspects of the game, you're going to get quite a bit of run in playing time because elite skills are hard to come by, and he's a knockdown three-point shooter and can stretch defenses on a Bulls team that doesn't have it. So that bodes well for him. That said, it's still really easy to find GIFs and Vines and any sort of reference on social media to Doug getting lost on defense. Video clips.
He's
because it's happened a couple times in the preseason where his guy is not in his frame of vision whatsoever. And it's kind of just comical at times. So he has to get that under control, and that takes time, effort, and a lot of attention. And I think he'll get better. It's going to be, you know, a long trek up the hill for Doug to be good defensively, or just get to average defensively, I should say. That's probably should be the goal now. But as long as he can bring shooting, that's what they need. And again, remember, you can hide guys on defense. You can minimize their limitations within a system. Now, that was easier when Tom Thibodeau was a coach. He did that so well for 5 years in Chicago, obviously. But it's still capable, still something that should be in the Bulls' frame of mind moving forward here.
Yeah, I would say so. Now, a couple other notes on the game tomorrow. Denzel Valentine still rehabbing from that ankle injury. He will travel with the team to Omaha, but he will not play, according to Fred Hoiberg today at practice. Nikola Mirotic, with the back injury that he had against the Hornets on Monday, he will not play and he will not travel. He's going to stay behind to get treatment. Fred did say that he doesn't see Nico's injury as being a long-term thing, and I would imagine he'll probably... He said they're hoping to get him back in practice on Saturday, so if that goes as planned, then he'll most likely be available for opening night against the Celtics next Thursday.
Outlook for Denzel regarding the season opener?
Well, Fred didn't really say for sure, but he was asked if, you know, when he was talking about, you know, Denzel not basically missing most of training camp with this injury and not having, you know, being able to be practicing with the team and getting up to speed on the offense they're running, would he be comfortable playing him on opening night, you know, just not having that experience scrimmaging with the team? And Fred said, yeah, if the situation is right and the matchup is right, we would feel comfortable putting him out there. So that would make me think, he didn't explicitly say it, but it would make me think that they expect him to be ready by opening night, but that's not 100%.
Sounds like coach speak to me.
Absolutely.
Classic Fred Hoiberg there. The other topic of note from Bulls practice today, Michael Carter-Williams spoke for the first time at length about why he switched from number one to number seven before his Bulls career even got going. And if you didn't hear that, you should go back and check our podcast.
We did a whole 20-minute podcast
Monday
just
night
about
after the exhibition game against the Hornets, picking Derrick Rose's number initially, then admitting that the social media attention basically got to him. He was tipped off by his family, and he realized how upset Bulls fans were about him choosing number one. And a part of me wonders if that's only what he sees. I think anyone that doesn't have a problem with Michael Carter-Williams wearing number one probably just thinks, okay. And that might be 70% of the people. Maybe it's 50%. I don't know. We'd have to take an unscientific poll to find out, because we're all about unscientific things, of course. You know,
facts,
social
only
media, Twitter polls, stuff like that. But I think he probably didn't hear the people that didn't care, but those who did care were a very vocal minority, or possibly majority, we don't know. And he's going to go to number seven, and he explained why.
And he basically just said he didn't want it to be a distraction. He wanted people to just be focused on, even if it was only a few people that were mad about it, he just wanted people to be focused on how the team was playing and not have some people say, oh, why is he wearing Derrick Rose's number? And so he reiterated once again that he picked that number. He wasn't even thinking about it being Derrick's old number. He picked it because it was the number he wore in college, and it was the number he wore his rookie year in Philly when he won Rookie of the Year, and he just wanted to kind of get back to his roots, which there's no reason not to believe him about that.
Yeah, well, I certainly believe him. I mean, the part I kind of get a kick out of or a chuckle is we haven't even entered the regular season yet, and Bulls Twitter has basically decided a practical decision for someone here with the Bulls, and the season hasn't even started. Now, I don't think Bulls Twitter is going to lead to any playing time shifts with any Bulls or play calling, but it is kind of comical that they affected a decision so much from Michael Carter-Williams.
So on the subject of Derrick Rose, we have been talking throughout the summer about his civil sexual assault lawsuit that he's been involved in Los Angeles, and we should say that today the verdict came in from the jury in that trial, and he and his two co-defendants, his two friends, were cleared of all charges, found not liable, and he, yeah, that happened today.
Yep, the case is basically closed. The Los
she
Angeles
did, her lawyers did say that they're contemplating an appeal, but I mean, I would imagine with, you know, the jurors that spoke to media afterwards said that they just didn't find her credible. You and I are not going to go into our own personal opinions about this case, because it's just not really our place to do that. But from the way it looks, I wasn't really surprised that he won the case, because it seemed like that was just the way it was going. If you read the, you know, the stuff from the last few days of coverage of it, and then
So the Los Angeles Police Department still had an open criminal investigation, but if you don't find a preponderance of evidence in the civil case, there's almost no chance whatsoever you're going to find anything beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case. So that's not a concern. Derrick Rose should be back for the next season opener. He did release a statement saying, "It was important to prove that I did not do what I was being accused of, even if it meant publicly sharing very private details about my personal life. I'm thankful that the jury understood and agreed with me. This experience and my sensitivity to it was deep. I'm ready to put this behind me and focus on my family and career." So,
and then there was also a statement from Adidas that said that he
full support.
He's not. He has a pretty big shoe deal with Adidas, and there was talk that if he didn't, you know, if he was found liable in this case, that maybe there would be some kind of morals clause in his contract with Adidas, and they could get out of it and, you know, terminate their relationship with him. Since he was cleared of all charges, they released a statement saying that they're still going to work with Derrick.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's another layer on Derrick Rose's legacy.
And I would be shocked if the NBA did anything.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I mean, business speaking, professionally and personally, I mean, Derrick Rose was cleared of wrongdoing by the jury in this case. And it's still what he says is going to be associated with him. So
yeah, this is not going to. I think it's going to fade away somewhat, especially if he plays well. But it's not going to go away, and I don't necessarily know if it should either.
Well, yeah, I mean, it opens a window to a broader culture and conversation that people far smarter than us will I'm sure. But you know what he says on the stand, all that he said, that adds to Derrick Rose, and we know that he's had a lot of rocky moments in explaining himself. We know that he doesn't understand everything or view everything in the same light as others. He had some moments that were really ugly for him on the stand that came off as misogynist. And, you know, he grew up in a little bit of a different culture, which doesn't, he didn't view right and wrong in the
same
way
on
some topics.
And I think even though he won the case, it's totally, you know, we're not telling anybody how to feel or how not to feel about him. But if you decide you want to look at some of the stuff that he said on the record in this case and decide that that's going to change the way you view him, I think it's totally fair game.
Yeah, I mean, everything when you're a public figure gets added up into that, so.
And I would also like to say, no matter how you feel about the case or how you don't feel about the case or whether you agree with him getting off or not, I think him posing for pictures with the jurors afterwards is not a good look.
Yeah.
It's just not a thing to do.
We know that Derek's never been aware of all the optics with everything, and that was a bad look. The judge made a joke about rooting for Derrick Rose, except for when he plays the Lakers. The case, of course, was in Los Angeles, so that was kind of where that stemmed from. So there was stuff that was certainly off-putting that you wish you hadn't seen. He doesn't sound like he's going to talk at length about it again on the record. The statement will serve and everything. So
it's going to be really interesting.
Moving on,
it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays on November 4th when the Knicks come back here.
Just a reception
to play the Bulls, because you know he's going to get, could be just because of, you know, what he meant to the city, being a local kid and being the youngest MVP in league history, he's going to get the video tribute. It's going to get a huge response from fans. There's going to be a lot of number one jerseys in the crowd. And this is just kind of there hanging over it. And even though he won the case, it's still, you know, this is still there.
It's not just that. It's comments he's made about the city of Chicago. He said they took him for granted and he wasn't quite
right
as loved, certainly.
Well, that stuff is obviously not nearly as serious as this. But, you know, there's a lot of things at play. Nothing is ever simple when it comes to Derrick Rose.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, certainly. So, I mean, there's some comments, too, that he's made about fans that they probably won't take in the best manner, but all in all, I think he will get a pretty good reception when he comes back. But we did want to get into some more Bulls questions you guys had. Hit us up on Twitter, @LockedOnBulls. You can always email us @LockedOnBulls@gmail.com. Find myself on Twitter, @CodyWesterlin. Find Sean @Hyken. Dwayne via Twitter asks, aside from drawing fouls, what other above-average offensive skill or skills does Jimmy Butler have?
Oh, he is good at getting to the rim. He can shoot from the mid-range. He's not a good outside shooter right now, but he's had good years there in the past. He's a good playmaker. I think he's an underrated passer.
I think he's really... I think I'd have to check the numbers, but judging by them previously when I wrote about him and just my kind of eye test, he's good at finishing at the rim too, I believe. And that's a big thing, because you can have tall trees in there, big men, and Jimmy can still finish over him. And part of that plays into getting fouled, too, obviously. He's not afraid. He's not scared at all to throw his body into there. He can get out in transition. I think he needs to work on running as much as Rajon Rondo does, so the Bulls can get some easy, fast break points. But offensively, he certainly improved that three-point shooting a couple off seasons ago. Was a point of emphasis for him. It kind of went south last year with that three-point shooting not being where he wanted to be. But he has also, as you point out, the playmaking. Ball handling was a big deal for Jimmy. I think it was summer 2015, the playmaking with the pick and roll. So he's added that. He's far more comfortable in the pick and roll than when he came up in the NBA. You would have been shocked to view him as an kind of every play pick and roll guy for stretches like the Bulls went to him in the fourth quarter of games last year. So good in the pick and roll, much better, I should say, than he was before. So I'd say that's probably above average. And when I say that, like, he doesn't see the floor like Steve Nash does in the pick and roll, but his ability to do multiple things out of the pick and roll, including getting to the hoop, knocking down an open mid-range jump shot, or being comfortable enough to make a good pass, I think is all speaking to his above average offensive skills, which would take off in a huge way if he ever got good at three-point shooting.
Right, and then I think just beyond that, what really makes him elite is his defense.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He has the offensive, certainly.
No, I know the question was about offense, but it's like when you put together, he's pretty good at a lot of offensive things, and he's an elite defender. So yeah. When you put all that together, yeah, that's kind of why he has the reputation he has.
Number one Bulls fan via Twitter asks, how deep will the Bulls rotation go?
Now, I actually asked Fred about this at practice because we care about our listeners at Locked On Bulls. We want to make sure you get stuff straight from the source.
Anything you want to relay to Fred Hoiberg, let us know.
Absolutely.
We'll do our best.
You know, I mean, certainly nothing that's going to get us fired or get our credentials revoked. We're going to ask him. But, like, you know, I asked him today basically that same question. I said, in an ideal world with everybody healthy and available, how deep is your rotation? How many people will you play off the bench? And he basically just kind of danced around it the way that coaches dance around a lot of things. He says that a strength of the team is how much depth that he has. He didn't give a number for how many people in the rotation, but you and I just kind of spitballing this. Obviously, the starting lineup, I think, is what it's going to be with, you know, Jimmy, Rondo, Wade, Taj, and Lopez is most likely the starting lineup. He hasn't 100% confirmed that Taj is going to start at the four, but I mean, we can kind of read between the lines on that one at this point. Now, we think Nico is going to get some minutes.
Doug is obviously
going to get some minutes because they don't have anyone else that can shoot. I think Michael Carter-Williams at this point is probably going to be the backup point guard. So that's eight already. And then either
Bobby... You got to have a big man.
You got to have a big... So either Bobby Portis or Chris Felicio. I would lean towards Felicio because I think he's played better in the preseason than Portis has. But Portis was also a first-round pick a year ago, so the team is going to be a little bit more invested in developing him and giving him those chances. So that's nine right there, and most teams will play like a 9 or 10 deep rotation, so that might leave you know, a guy like, you know, Jaren Grant, Spencer Dinwiddie, Denzel Valentine until he gets the ankle
so,
back.
So
those guys might all just be on the outside looking
in. Yeah, I think Denzel's kind of the tipping point there between maybe 9 and 10, man. If he can get caught up after missing most of the preseason with this ankle injury and bring him something, be a little unique, have that playmaking skill set on the second unit, and set up guys like Doug McDermott maybe for some open three-point shots and see the floor well, I think they can go 10-man rotation there. But generally speaking, like, you'll see 10 or 11 men in the box score, but a couple of those guys only might get like
a minute
or two, something like that. So in theory, that's like a 9 or 10, but practically speaking, a lot of NBA rotations in the regular season are around 9.
So who would you – so here's a question. This doesn't really mean a lot, but – let's just say everybody's healthy. Let's say Nico is healthy and available and Denzel is available and healthy. There are going to be 15 guys in the roster. You have to make two of them inactive. Who are the two inactives going to be? I think Paul Zipser is one, but who's the other?
Oh, I didn't think that far ahead. I mean, off the top of my head, I would say Spencer Dinwiddie or Jaren Grant, whoever's below on the depth chart.
I would agree, and I would think that Dinwiddie is probably ahead a little bit of Jaren, but he did not play in the game the other
day. Yeah, that's true. So maybe Grant is edging up there. But in the past, the Bulls often have carried 13 men, and if they didn't carry 13 men, if they had 14, half of them, it seemed like, were hurt. So that decision never had to be made. They just put the hurt guy.
Right. Like, you always have, like, oh, Derrick Rose is out for however long. Joakim Noah is out. Pau Gasol is out. Like, they've always got guys that to do that. But It's worth pointing out, by the way, on the roster thing, that Spencer Dinwiddie's contract doesn't become guaranteed until November 1st. So if anybody's going to be on the chopping block, it's him. But I would imagine that they're going to keep him.
I don't even think it's fully guaranteed until January. So there's a couple levels of pay there. Did want to get to a question from James on Twitter. Does Michael Carter-Williams have a lock on the backup point guard position, or is he just entering the race? I would say he's the clubhouse leader, no doubt.
I think you're probably right about that. And just from what Fred said today at practice, they're going to give him a lot of looks tomorrow. He's going to actually play. He practiced with the team for the first time today. Fred said he looked good. And we talked to MCW, and he said that he felt comfortable. He knew a lot of the offense already. He felt comfortable playing it. So it doesn't seem like, and he also just seems like a smart kid. So I don't think there's that much of a learning curve there. But my thing is, clearly when they made this trade, part of it was because they actually got an offer of something for Tony Snell. Mm-hmm. That was part of it. But the other part of it was that I don't think they're in love with any of the options of backup point guards. So, they've played throughout the preseason. They've seen what they have in Spencer Dinwiddie. They've seen what they had in Jaron Grant. They've seen what they have in Isaiah Cannon, who I still think is more of an Aaron Brooks type, just kind of instant offense guy off the bench than he is a backup point guard. So if they aren't really looking at any of those guys, Dinwiddie or Grant, and saying, this is our guy, this is our backup point guard, then I think, you know, those guys have already gotten the chance to earn that spot. So at least at the start of the season, I think MCW is going to be the one getting those minutes.
Yeah, and it should be pointed out that MCW has a higher ceiling than any of those
guys
competing with. He was 11th overall draft pick in 2013. Guy who won Rookie of the Year, flashed a lot of potential, just couldn't shoot, couldn't stay efficient, didn't have a good setting. I mean, that was a losing culture in Philadelphia.
He also setting ups, in Milwaukee. He also ups the number of good defenders on this roster from three. Because the three before that were Jimmy, Taj, and Robin. There are now four good defenders on the roster.
You think the Bulls will ever go to the nuclear defensive five-man unit and put those four in a fifth capable defender together?
Like, I don't know, Rondo or something?
Oh my god, then there would really be no shooting ever at all.
Well, there's gonna... So, what, Rondo, MCW, Jimmy...
I don't think Rondo and MCW... Like, that would be the worst backcourt shooting of all time if they walk out there
together. See, that's the part... But Fred did say... I mean, I think part of the reason that they're thinking this is gonna work is because everywhere else that he's been... MCW, he's been the starter or thought of as the starter. He's clearly not the starter at point guard here. He's going to be backing up Rondo. And so what Fred said today was that he sees him as running the second unit and getting guys more shots. And so if he's on the floor with guys like Doug who can shoot, then it's maybe not going to matter as much that he can't shoot. And his playmaking is more just what's going to come into play.
I have an idea. So Jimmy was talking the other night. He was kind of chastising himself in the locker room for saying the Bulls gamble too much defensively, he thinks.
Right.
Dating back to last year and in this preseason, which I found to be contradictory because the Bulls had the worst turnover force percentage rate in the NBA last year. So if they were gambling a lot last year, they were the worst gamblers maybe there's ever been to do something a lot and have zero results off of it. But he thought he set a bad example at times for the Bulls in gambling too much. Put Jimmy, Rondo, MCW out in the same lineup. Like, they would be going for steals left and right, out of position gambling, flying around, just trying to cherry pick buckets on easy steals and dunks. Like, you know, Rondo, I mean, he's always among the steals leaders in the NBA when he's gotten minutes and been engaged defensively, if I remember right. And MCW has that, like, ceiling. Like, we could get a little three-man unit out there that just gambles incessantly and see what happens. Wouldn't you get a kick out of that?
Nah, it would be interesting. And then, you know, you put a guy like Bobby Portis out there who's probably just going to be, like, trying to get blocks.
Yeah, just go get those counting stats defensively, not care about the rotations and such.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we'll keep an eye out on the gambling Bulls defense, see how that goes. But as always, you can email us at LockedOnBulls with any basketball-related questions.
LockedOnBulls@gmail.com.
Yeah, whatever. Not what I said, what Sean said. Follow us on Twitter at LockedOnBulls, at Cody Westerlin, at Hyken, and most of all, please subscribe to us.
That's right. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Audio Boom, TuneIn, Google Play. Make sure you leave us 5-star reviews. Check out the other podcasts in the Locked On Podcast Network. You can subscribe to The Athletic to read my work covering the Bulls. You can subscribe to read 670 The Score, listen to 670 The Score, support Cody. And we will be back with you soon.